Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com. And today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the announcement today by Secretary of State Pompeo that the U.S. is repudiating a 1978 State Department legal opinion finding Israeli settlements in the occupied territories inconsistent with international law. Khalid El-Gindi, a fellow at the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, who served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009, whose latest book is Blind Spot, America and the Palestinians from Balfour to Trump, joins us to discuss this latest in a series of moves by the Trump administration to weaken Palestinian claims to statehood. We'll assess whether this is yet another bone thrown by Trump to support the beleaguered Netanyahu and pander to the Christian Zionist evangelicals in his base, or an effort to make up for Trump's catastrophic decision to sell out Israel's friends, the Kurds, and hand over Syria to Putin, Assad, and the Iranians. With more than 700,000 Israeli settlers already in the occupied territories, Palestinians are being squeezed into a smaller piece of the less desirable territory they occupy. And although the rest of the world still recognizes the illegality of Israeli settlements, whatever leverage the Europeans have over Israel apparently is not being applied. Furthermore, until there is a competent and cohesive Palestinian leadership, it is unlikely the Palestinians will get any help from the international community, particularly if further eruptions in the Middle East relegate them to the back burner. Then we'll speak with Rachel Van Landingham, who is a professor of law at Southwestern Law School and a former judge advocate in the United States Air Force. She was the legal advisor for international law at the United States Central Command Headquarters, overseeing operational and legal issues related to the armed conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan. And we will discuss President Trump's pardoning of U.S. servicemen who are murderers and have been convicted of war crimes. And we'll assess the role Trump's penchant for being tough and admiring toughness played in this decision, emphatically opposed by the Pentagon and his own Secretary of Defense. Then finally, we'll look into the leaked reports from Iran's Ministry of Intelligence and Security, which were sent to The Intercept and The New York Times by an Iraqi patriot who wanted to, quote, let the world know what Iran is doing in my country, Iraq. Nada Hashemi, the director of Middle East Studies at the University of Denver and author of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future, joins us to discuss the growing pressure on Iran's supreme leader and his repressive militias who are shooting down young Iraqis in the streets while Iran's own people are rising up against the regime over a hike in gas prices amid an internet blackout. And joining us now is Khalid El-Gindi, who's a fellow at the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He previously served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel and was a key participant in the Annapolis negotiations launched in November 2007. And his latest book is Blind Spot, America and the Palestinians from Balfour to Trump. Welcome to Background Briefing, Khalid El-Gindi.
Thanks for having me.
And today, Khalid, the Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announced that the U.S. is softening its position on the settlements in the West Bank. And basically, he's repudiating a 1978 State Department legal opinion that civilian settlements in the occupied territories were, quote, inconsistent with international law. So this is yet another gift to Israel. I'm not sure how much of a gift it is to Netanyahu, because he's sort of hanging by a thread, isn't he?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's still very much, his future is very much up in the air. We don't know yet who will be able to form a government in Israel.
But what kind of impact does it have? I mean, in other words, is this throwing a bone for domestic Israeli purposes?
I think it's really working on two levels. Part of it is domestic Israeli purposes, but the other part is, I would say the bigger part is domestic American purposes. There is a big constituency that supports Donald Trump and all of the moves that he's made with regard to Israel and the Palestinians, recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital, sanctioning the PLO, basically eliminating all forms of assistance to the Palestinians everywhere, and shutting down the Palestinian embassy in Washington. These are all things that the radical right in America, the evangelicals in particular, have been calling for. And that is very much in line with the far-right agenda of the so-called Greater Israel crowd in Israel, who want to maintain permanent control over the occupied territories, of course, without enfranchising the 5 million Palestinians who live there. So this is, I would say, par for the course, given where the Trump administration has been almost from day one.
Well, there are about 700,000 Israeli settlers now living in the West Bank's two areas, and it's always been considered to be an impediment to a future settlement. And the, as far as I can tell, the Likud and the Israeli right have never actually announced what their real policies are. But at the end of the day, it seems that they somehow expect the Palestinians to sort of go away, which is clearly not happening, even though the Palestinians are divided. And of course, there's been a lot of rocket fire from the Gaza into Israel and Israeli strikes on Islamic Jihad leaders in Gaza. So what difference will the elections make? Because even some of the Palestinian Israelis who are in the Knesset weren't too happy about Gantz, even though Gantz needs them to become the next leader of Israel.
Right. I don't think there is a whole lot of difference between the two sides, between the Gantz, the blue and white coalition, and Netanyahu's coalition. They both have said that they would maintain Israeli so-called settlement blocks forever, that Israel would remain in the Jordan Valley forever, and that they would not uproot settlements. So it really is a question of style over substance, really. I think that's where they differ. But the Palestinian issue is not really a front burner issue in the Israeli elections, except to the extent that Palestinian citizens of Israel, unlike those in the occupied territories, are clearly playing a role in that they seem to be pivotal in terms of which side they end up supporting, who they will endorse to form a government. But just to back up on this question of U.S. policy, because I think it's important to point out that we didn't get here by accident. This isn't a kind of, it's not necessarily a huge shock in the sense of, sure, we know where Trump was coming from. He's very much in favor of basically permanent occupation of the Palestinians and eliminating chances for a two-state solution. But as far as the policy itself, American presidents since Ronald Reagan have been eroding that policy that you mentioned, the 1978 determination by the State Department that settlements are illegal, which of course is the international consensus on Israeli settlements as well. But you know, almost every president since Ronald Reagan has been gradually moving away from that policy and has been eroding that international consensus. So, you know, we didn't get here by accident. It didn't happen in a vacuum. As radical and as reckless as Trump's policies are, it's important to remember that the way for basically the path had already been paved by previous American presidents who would sort of talk out of both sides of their mouths. On the one hand, we don't like settlements, but they're not illegal. They're not obstacles to peace, in which case, why would Israel refrain from building in the settlements? So this is part, I think this is the culmination of a gradual erosion in U.S. policy, and this is kind of the exclamation point on that repudiation, which has been happening steadily over time.
And again, I'm speaking with Khaled El-Gindi. He's a fellow at the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He previously served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009 and was a key participant in the Annapolis negotiations launched in November of 2007. And his latest book is Blind Spot, America and the Palestinians from Balfour to Trump. So just in terms of the motivations for this move by the State Department, by Mike Pompeo, who himself, of course, is a Christian Zionist. I mean, he believes in the rapture, which is, scares the hell out of me, frankly. I just think it's a conflict of interest being a steward of U.S. national security and having an investment in the end of the world. But I guess that's a conversation for another day. Is what's going on here something to do with the fact that the Israeli military intelligence establishment, and I imagine by extension Netanyahu and Gantz, were just totally alarmed by Trump's deal with Erdogan and the sellout of the Kurds? And the Israelis have very close relationships with the Kurds, not just in Syria, but also in Iraq. And people like Michael Loren, the former Israeli ambassador to the U.S., believe that now that the cork is out of the bottle, in a sense, that the U.S. has handed over Syria to Russia and Iran, that Iran might start beefing up Hezbollah and start raining down missiles on Israel within months, as he's been writing about. So is this a way to sort of heal that wound?
It could be. I think it's not clear that there is a direct causal relationship. I think there is real coherence and consistency in the Trump approach to Israel and the Palestinians, independent of anything else. This is consistent with the State Department removing the word occupied and occupation from its internal memos and discussions. It's consistent with their move away from the two-state solution and sort of normalizing settlements, recognizing Israel's annexation of Jerusalem. These are all very, very consistent policies that are internally coherent, independent of anything else. So it could be a way to assuage the Israelis on some of these other differences that they're having. But I don't really see a causal relationship. Instead, I see an extension of a policy that they have been implementing pretty consistently almost since day one.
Well, but that's why I mentioned earlier, Khaled El-Gindi, that, you know, why doesn't somebody call out the Israeli right and even, I guess, the blue and white, the center, on what's your end game with the Palestinians? I mean, don't you think it's time... Yeah. To be honest about this, as these settlements grow and now they're being legitimized by the White House, isn't it just a gradual way of denying or squeezing the Palestinians into a smaller and smaller territory?
It is. And there's no question that's the goal. The goal is to take Palestinian statehood off of the table, take it off the agenda, and to basically normalize Israel's permanent control over the occupied territories and the 5 million Palestinians who live in them. There's no question that is the goal, but it's important to keep in mind that as influential and important an actor that the United States is, there is still an international consensus, and it's pretty clear that the United States is, along with Israel, are the outliers on this. There are not other countries that are following suit. This is a very different reality than we've seen in the past, where Europe and the Arab states tend to follow Washington's lead. That's not happening in this case at all.
So if the U.S., as it is, out of step with the rest of the world, the Europeans surely have some leverage. Don't they have a lot of trading with Israel? And they also... Israel's very concerned about this BDS movement, which is fairly alive and well in Europe and growing here in the United States, although Trump administration's, through the Department of Education, is trying to criminalize anybody that talks about Palestinian statehood and just enforce a one-sided narrative about Israeli-Palestinian issue. What leverage does the Europeans have over the United States and by extension, over Israel?
I mean, theoretically, the Europeans could, of course, but we saw recently what it took for the EU even to uphold its own policy and rules regarding the labeling of Israeli settlement products in Europe. That is part of their trade with Israel. It took a decision by the European Court of Justice to affirm the necessity of labeling Israeli settlement products as not products of Israel, that the fact that they were produced in the occupied territories. So even that whole idea of truth in advertising or truth in marketing, it took a long time for the EU to uphold its own policy because they have these vested economic interests in terms of their trade with Israel. So theoretically, they have that ability, they have that power, but it's a question of political will. Are they prepared to kind of put their money where their mouth is when it comes to Israeli settlements? I think there will be growing pressure on them to do exactly that. Whether they're able to do that as a matter of consensus in European policy, and whether that will end up actually affecting Israeli behavior is another matter and still remains to be seen. But I think this will underscore the need for the Europeans and the broader international community to insist on international law and international legitimacy, because this Trump administration, it's fairly clear, I think, on Israel and Palestine, but also on a range of other issues, that they are quite openly and explicitly opposed to international law and even the idea of a rules-based international order. And this is something that is a direct threat to the Europeans and to the global order in general.
So just in the last couple of minutes, what's your sense of what's going on in Syria now that the U.S. has basically handed it over to Putin and to some extent to the Iranians? We know that Netanyahu has a close relationship with Vladimir Putin. And as I mentioned earlier, this former ambassador, Israel's ambassador to the United States, Michael Oren, has been writing about the possibility of Iran resupplying Hezbollah with more and more missiles and starting to rain them down on Israel. And he thinks that there'll be a war within months and it will be quite devastating. So do you see, if that's all a possibility, and then of course the role that Russia appears to be playing now is to restrain Iran, if that's possible, do you think that the Palestinian issue will therefore be relegated to the back burner if they've got this threat on the horizon?
I think not just events in Syria, but events all over the region are kind of pushing the Palestinian issue to the back burner. I think on Syria, the decision by the administration to kind of cut and run has left a vacuum in northern Syria that's been filled, obviously, by the Turks, but also by the Russians, by Iran, and of course, the regime in Damascus. It's a hugely detrimental policy. It undercuts American credibility, the fact that international actors cannot look to the United States to uphold its end of the bargain or to stay true to its word. They're basically sending the message that the United States cannot be relied upon as an ally, as a friend, as a supporter. That's a message that is being heard certainly in Israel, but it's also being heard by others in the region, and it's also being heard by America's enemies and adversaries. So it's a very dangerous situation. But in terms of the Palestinian issue, it was already on the back burner. And I think it's certainly going to push more in that direction. But it's really up to the Palestinians. And I think it's important to point out that the Palestinians, although they don't have equal power to the Israelis, they do have equal agency. And the Palestinians, were they to have an effective and credible political leadership, would I think be able to better put their issue on the international agenda than what we are seeing today. And the absence of a coherent Palestinian leadership is contributing, I think, to the ability of other parties to put the Palestinian issue on the back burner.
Well, Khaled Al-Gindi, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Khalid El-Gindi. He's a fellow at the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He previously served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009 and was a key participant in the Annapolis negotiations launched in November 2007. And his latest book is Blind Spot, America and the Palestinians from Balfour to Trump. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with more of Background Briefing on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com.
There's a woman on my block, just sits there, facing the hill, saying, who's gonna take away?
Who's gonna take away?
Who's gonna take away?
Who's gonna take away?
His license to kill. Now he's hell-bent for destruction.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Lieutenant Colonel Rachel Van Landingham, who is a professor of law at Southwestern Law School and a former judge advocate in the United States Air Force. She was a legal advisor for international law at the United States Central Command's headquarters, where she advised on operational and international legal issues related to the armed conflicts in Afghanistan and Iraq, and also served as the command's chief liaison to the International Committee of the Red Cross, as well as providing advice to the Department of Justice regarding habeas cases brought on behalf of detainees in Afghanistan. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lieutenant Colonel Rachel Van Landingham.
Thank you so much. And it's just professor now. Thank you.
Professor. Okay. I understand you're retired, but your background is important since you've had firsthand knowledge of the issues involved in the treatment of prisoners in U.S. custody. And the president appears to have basically gone ahead and pardoned some special forces operators who many consider to be rogue operators, some of whom were facing serious prison time. And I mean, let's start with the president's pardon. It looks as if he just did it on his own. This is something that he wanted to do. It's certainly not something the Pentagon wanted to do or the Secretary of Defense wanted to do.
Of course not, because real commanders know that this is dangerous. And so the Secretary of the Army was speaking on behalf of his military commanders when he asked the president to allow Major Goldstein's court-martial to continue. So there's several different things going on here. One, they weren't just the individuals that he pardoned weren't just considered rogue operators. They were convicted war criminals, convicted by their peers, by fellow service members, not by lawyers, but by fellow combat veterans. So let's be clear about that. So there's been two lieutenants, as well as a sergeant, that were all convicted war criminals because that President Pardon has issued full pardons for, because he issued two earlier pardons regarding a Sergeant Miller and a Lieutenant Bahana. Both of them were convicted of murdering detainees in their custody. And then he, of course, just pardoned Lieutenant Laurent, who was on Friday, who was convicted of murder as well as attempted murder as well as obstruction of justice by a jury of uniformed members of his peers who full well understand the operational complexities, the proverbial fog of war. So I want to be careful to ensure and to call these things as they are. And then we have another situation altogether, which is the Major Goldstein case. And again, Major Goldstein was a Army Green Beret who was charged by the first, it's called preferral of charges, by a military commander, not by a lawyer, by a military commander, because in the military, the criminal justice system is one that is operated and run by military commanders. And then it's, of course, operationalized by lawyers in the courtroom, as well as judges and appellate courts going all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, with the full panoply of procedural safeguards that an accused would get in the U.S. federal system. But these commander, but with Major Goldstein, his commander had decided that there was credible evidence that he had murdered an Afghan civilian. And when there's a credible allegation of a war crime, and here it would be a war crime because in a combat situation, soldiers are allowed to kill enemy belligerents. They're not allowed to kill civilians unless those civilians are participating in hostilities, pose a threat. And so would there be a factual issue on whether or not that individual posed a threat? That's what juries are for. That's what judicial process is for. That's what courts martial are for. He may have been acquitted, and he should be if there's any reasonable doubt whatsoever that he did not commit an unlawful killing, a murder in time of combat. However, President Trump subverted that entire process by doing so. He kicked out the court-martial. The court-martial hadn't even met yet. It was only at the very first stage of preferral of charges by the commander. The commander had a duty, as a legal, ethical, and moral duty, to bring those charges regarding credible allegations of a war crime. And the process to resolve those fully and fairly for the accused is the military justice system that was established before the Constitution by George Washington. So it has a very, very long pedigree. It's been completely overhauled. It has more oversight than any other criminal justice system in the United States. Why? Because Congress has the constitutional duty to provide rules regulating the military, and part of their oversight is to provide oversight on the criminal justice system. So by taking out Major Goldstein's case completely from the system, that's not rule of law, that's rule of man. And that's dangerous because we have processes. Processes are set up to operationalize values and to ensure there isn't arbitrary wielding of power. And secondly, it also undermines the commanders. Commanders have to have use this military justice system, have been given it for over two centuries in order to ensure that there's accountability for misconduct, to ensure their orders are followed. And so by completely ripping the rug underneath the commanders, that sends a dangerous message to whether or not commanders should be obeyed. It's subtle, but it's there. There's strategic legitimacy issues here too, but what would you like me to answer?
Well, let me just remind the audience that I'm speaking with Rachel Van Landingham, who's a professor of law at Southwestern Law School and a former judge advocate in the United States Air Force, and she was a legal advisor for international law at the United States Central Command's headquarters, where she advised on operational and international legal issues related to the armed conflicts in Afghanistan and Iraq, and she also served as the command's chief liaison to the International Committee of the Red Cross, as well as providing advice to the Department of Justice regarding habeas cases brought on behalf of detainees in Afghanistan.
Can I add something that because I think it's important. I was also a prosecutor, a defense counsel, and an appellate defense counsel. My criminal law litigation experience is on the defense side, and I teach criminal law as well as national security law, including the laws of armed conflict. So I come at it from a more holistic perspective and one with utter empathy and sympathy for the individuals who stand accused of crimes, who deserve every reasonable doubt and to deserve a full process. That's my real concern here is the institutional challenge this presents to full and fair process. If you can take charges out of the process, what does that do to being able to rely on the process? What does that do to the soldiers also regarding their adherence to the law of armed conflict? So I'd like to pivot a bit from criminal law issues and turn to the law of armed conflict, the law of war. These soldiers weren't just convicted of murdering someone in downtown Los Angeles or Houston or where have you in the United States. Two of these individuals, the Sergeant Miller and Lieutenant Bahena, were convicted of killing detainees, a naked defenseless detainee in the Lieutenant Bahena's case, in a combat zone, which is a fundamental flagrant violation of the law of armed conflict that the United States helped develop under the Lieber Code under President Lincoln during the Civil War. The reason, and that it manifests American values in how we fight. We fight with more what according to values and according to morals, and those are encapsulated and enshrined in the law. We don't kill civilians that aren't trying to kill us. We treat our detainees humanely, and of course that's been observed in the breach, as we know with Abu Ghraib. But that's the goal, that's the rule, that's the law, and we only kill enemy belligerents. So when those rules are stepped out from beyond, when they're transgressed, commanders have a legal and ethical and moral duty to hold those transgressors, those violators to account. Because think of, and it's a betrayal by President Trump. President Trump's pardons betray the rank and file soldier, sailor, Marine, airman, airwoman, Coast Guardsman, who had to put themselves, they volunteered themselves to be an incredibly morally and physically and emotionally and mentally draining and challenging situations. And yet they adhered to these laws. They adhered to their commander's orders. Can you imagine, for example, put yourself in the shoes of a 19-year-old from middle America who is fighting in Afghanistan, and his platoon runs over, part of his platoon is a Humvee, and it's destroyed by an IED, an improvised explosive device. Shortly thereafter, he and his fellow platoon mates, the ones that survived the blast, find the alleged, someone that they think, an Afghan that they think actually made the IED, and they detain him. You can only imagine the type of moral courage it takes not to want to kill that detainee. Of course, they want to, but not to do it. And the vast, vast, vast majority of military members are able to handle that situation with honor and integrity and according to American values and according to the law because of their commander's training, because of their non-commissioned officers' training, because of good leadership, and because of being a good American. And President Trump betrays all of that.
Well, I was going to ask you the question, I think, which you largely answered, and that is that it seems that the system is in many ways stacked in favor of the defendants in the military, because the military, above all, and they have the unique position to understand the fog of war and the difficulties that people go under. So it's not like the rules are stacked against the defendants. And the other thing, you just ended on the note I wanted to also touch on, which is, you know, early in President Trump's tenure, he spoke before a group of police in Suffolk County, New York, where he urged the police to be rougher on those that they arrested. And he said, you know, specifically, you know, don't put your hand on the head of the arrestee when you're putting him in the back of the police cruiser. You know, that's too nice. So there's something about President Trump that equates being rough, mean, vicious, cruel, that sort of manliness, that's being tough. And of course, he has an affection for despots around the world. And he's mentioned many times that he likes Putin because he's tough. He likes Erdogan because he's tough. So what's this obsession with toughness?
I'm not a psychologist, and I don't pretend to get into President Trump's head. But I think you have hit upon a very consistent theme. But it's also an obsession with toughness that doesn't understand it is much tougher. It takes so much more moral courage and guts and iron will to do the right thing and not to kill the detainee in your custody that you think is responsible for the loss of five of your fellow American soldiers that were on your left and right. That is true mental toughness. Just going around indiscriminately killing or just killing anyone that you want to, despite your commander's orders, only to kill those enemy belligerents that your commander says to kill, but to step outside and say, I'm just going to kill whomever, that's not toughness. That's not toughness at all. That shows a lack of discipline and a lack of honor. That's what he fundamentally doesn't understand. That's true cowardice. That is true cowardice. He has the idea of honor and discipline and toughness completely perverted, completely reversed. He doesn't understand it, and he honors those who fundamentally don't understand it. And America wins its wars and eventually and maintains strategic legitimacy when it does, because it fights with honor, and we fight the way according to our values. Because you know who doesn't? ISIS, Al-Qaeda, our extremist enemies, they don't care about the law of war. Guess what? They're going to lose because they don't fight according to the values that we all hold dear. And if we go down that slippery slope, we're going to lose too.
So do you think that the fact that the so-called adults in the room, the generals, have been effectively purged by Trump, talking about McMaster, Mattis, etc. There's nobody around him, right, to tell him what you're telling our audience now, Rachel Van Landingham. I'm not making excuses for the president, but it does seem that there aren't any guardrails anymore.
Well, that's, you know, I'll push back a bit on that. He has a Secretary of Defense. He has a Secretary of Army who went in and laid it out to him. I'm sure I wasn't in the room, but the Secretary of the Army was lobbying on behalf of his military commanders. What I'm saying isn't rocket science. What I'm saying isn't some, you know, brilliant insight on my behalf. This is fundamental basic military operational effectiveness and fundamental basic, this is how America fights. And when we don't, think me lie, we suffer for it. Think Abu Ghraib, we suffer for it. Those were strategic setbacks. We don't just fight this way because of pie in the sky humanity and morality. We fight this way because in the long term, it works. It works. We win the war. So there's the huge, huge pragmatic part of it. And so his secretaries know that. He disregards them because he fundamentally doesn't care. He thinks it's the classic sign of, well, again, I'm not a psychologist, it's narcissistic behavior. He thinks he is right despite individuals that have vastly more experience and understanding than he does in these matters. He does not care. He only cares about what he thinks. That is tyranny. And we are in democracy, and our democracy is weakened because of actions like this.
Well, you recall early in the Trump administration when he hired his first Secretary of Defense, General Mattis, that he referred to him as Mad Dog Mattis, which apparently really upset Mattis, and apparently Mattis was able to persuade him not to use that description or that title anymore. But then more recently, of course, Trump was very insulting about former Secretary of Defense Mattis, suggesting that he himself, Trump, knew better and that his generals weren't very good and he was an overrated general in the way that Meryl Streep is an overrated actress. So what's going on in the Pentagon? I mean, my assumption is that the people in the Pentagon, whether that's a different group of people to the people out in the field, but let's just start with the Pentagon. I imagine...
Well, I'll challenge you on that. The people at the Pentagon rotate through the field. You don't spend... Uh-huh. Those in uniform don't spend an entire career at the Pentagon. And if they did, they would jump off the roof of the Pentagon. Everyone dreads an assignment at the Pentagon because most individuals that voluntarily join the military do so because we want to be in the military. We want to be where the action is. You don't want to be right. Wearing a suit at the Pentagon. So I want to caution that. Yes, there are civilians that spend their whole lives there.
Right.
The military members, that's the last place they want to be. They want to be back with their troops, back with flying planes or on their ships or with their battalions, preparing and training for war and executing war. So I'd be careful to paint a broad brush there.
Well, but that makes it easier in terms of the question. What's going on with morale? I would assume that the rank and file, from officers down to enlisted personnel, are really supportive of Mattis, not of Trump, their commander-in-chief.
Well, again, Secretary Mattis, General Mattis, of course, did not like that moniker Mad Dog because that implies just a rabid, unconstrained use of force, rabid, unconstrained violence. And that's the antithesis of what our generals, what our leaders in the military, our commanders train our folks to do. They train our folks to provide discreet, managed, to manage violence in a discreet, focused way. Strategically, that comports with the law of war, but of course that comports with our values. Why? Because that's how we win. And so, of course, he didn't like that moniker. And of course, I'm sure Secretary Mattis is appalled at these types of pardons. For the rank and file military member, I'm not so sure. I ran into a Marine, recently retired Marine, in the airport yesterday, flying back from JFK. He was appalled. Does every single rank and file military member understand the complexity of these cases? I think often it's no, they don't. I think it's going to depend on the leadership in their unit, and it's fundamentally, and it's going to depend on what their news sources are, right? If they're only watching Fox News, they're getting a very warped and distorted and inaccurate picture of what's going on here. And so they may very well support these because they don't get to understand the big picture. And I don't blame them for that. However, I do put the onus on the commanders and the non-commissioned officers and the leaders of every single military unit out there to ensure that they keep up the training, to keep up the message and the fundamental understanding of, no, we fight with honor, we fight with distinction, we are professional forces. We don't revel in unconstrained violence. We don't revel in killing anyone. We don't want to kill anyone, but we know we have to, and when we train to have to, we're going to do with devastating lethality against the people that are trying to kill us and not against anyone else. So, but there is the concern now that when you train individuals to treat detainees humanely, for example, and then those who actually commit murder against detainees are pardoned, the commander's orders are weakened a bit. And I did have someone ask me yesterday on BBC, well, look, these are only a handful of cases. You've got millions of service members. What's the big deal? The big deal is that you've got the the White House. You have the president, you have the executive attention from the White House on these cases. And these pardons weren't done in the dead of the night. They were done with full fanfare to distract from impeachment proceedings on Friday. And they've been done in the context of a steady stream of tweets of vitriol that seemingly impugn both military commanders right now that are leading our troops, and they impugn the effectiveness of the law of war. Again, President Trump's comment about a tweet about, well, we train our boys, of course, because he forgets that, you know, women wear the uniform and can shoot just as effectively as men. We train our boys to be trained, or we train our boys to be trained fighters, and then we turn around and train killers, and then we turn around and prosecute them for killing. Of course, he's basically, in part of the overall context of all of his tweets, saying a few things there. First of all, he doesn't say that we're fighting, but we train our soldiers and sailors and Marines and airmen to fight with, they're trained killers according to law. Because if you don't kill the right people intentionally, you're a murderer. You're not just a killer, right? So of course the military are killers, but they're not murderers because they kill according to rules. So he's disregarding, he's implying that the rules don't matter, maybe that the rules actually hinder and are obstacles, hinder the effective application of force. And he's implying that it's courageous and honorable to go ahead and just do what these men did. And that betrays a lot of folks, and it betrays the American military ethos going back to the founding of this country. President Washington, when he was General Washington, told his troops that he was going to fight according to rules and that they better fight according to those rules too. This wasn't developed overnight. This wasn't developed by some human rights body in order to prevent Americans from winning on the battlefield or to prevent Israelis from winning. No, these rules were developed by us to help us win, and to do so at the same time according to our values and preserving the morality of our service members, of whom we ask a tremendous amount. And we owe them allegiance to these laws.
Well, Rachel Van Landingham, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. Have a wonderful afternoon.
And again, I've been speaking with Rachel Van Landingham, who is a professor of law at Southwestern Law School and a former judge advocate in the United States Air Force. She was the legal advisor for international law at the United States Central Command Headquarters, where she advised on operational and international legal issues related to the armed conflicts in Afghanistan and Iraq. And she also served as the command's chief liaison with the International Committee of the Red Cross, as well as providing advice to the Department of Justice regarding habeas cases brought on behalf of detainees in Afghanistan. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back with more of Background Briefing on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com.
Yeah, Hans, I've just noticed something.
These communists are all cowards.
Have you looked at our caps recently?
Our caps?
The badges on our caps. Have you looked at them?
What? No. A bit.
They've got skulls on them. Have you noticed that our caps have actually got little pictures of skulls on them?
I don't,
Hans, are we the baddies?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Nada Hashemi, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement, and The Struggle for Iran's Future. And his latest book is Sectarianization, Mapping the New Politics of the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nada Hashemi.
Thanks, Ian.
So somebody inside of Iraq, obviously in their intelligence service or somebody high up in their government, leaked to The Intercept 700 pages of secret intelligence reports from Iran's Ministry of Intelligence and Security, the MOIS, which is a pretty secretive organization which is pretty hard to penetrate. And these cables detail Iran's operations in Iraq from 2013 through 2015. And they are pretty extraordinary, don't you think?
Well, I agree. I think it's a major revelation that really confirms what we know. I mean, there's no real surprises here. Now we have the documentation that effectively proves that Iraq is a vassal state of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and that Iran holds extensive influence over the ebb and flow of Iraqi politics. And now we have the documents to prove it. And so what's interesting about these revelations is that they really affirm the demands of the protesters in Iraq who have been complaining about Iran's influence, you know, in the region and in their own country in particular. But also, I think these documents affirm one of the core grievances of people who are protesting in Iran today about how there's a lot of wasteful expenditure by the Islamic Republic of Iran in the region, in Iraq, and beyond Iran's borders. And that's been proven today by these leaked cables.
And the source who sent these, who leaked these cables to The Intercept and The New York Times, says that he wanted to let the world know what Iran is doing to my country, Iraq. But this is an extraordinary situation, isn't it, Nada, in the sense that you've got Iraq, a vassal state, thanks to George Bush and Dick Cheney's invasion, essentially handing it over to Iran, strategically at least, but now it seems in every sense they control it through the Revolutionary Guard Corps and these militias that they've set up. But you've got young Iraqis demonstrating in the streets, being shot down by these IRGC militias, the same people who turned the tide for Assad in Syria in 2019, when the people took to the streets in droves and the Syrian army didn't want to keep shooting their own people. So the Iranians stepped in with the IRGC and the Kurds, and they shot the Syrian civilians to the point where they essentially crippled the movement and turned it into a civil war. So there's no doubt about the ruthlessness of the IRGC and the militias. But you've got them projecting power next door and into Syria and into Lebanon. But at the same time, back home, you've got people demonstrating in huge numbers in Iran against the doubling of gas prices. And obviously, they're chafing the Iranian people under the American sanctions. So how do you see it in that context?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that the Islamic Republic of Iran is pursuing a lot of, repressive policies, both within its own borders and beyond. It's taking advantage of, missteps and mistakes that the United States has pursued in the region in the context of Iraq, the disastrous 2003 invasion, which had unintended consequences. One of them, what you just outlined, how Iran was the big beneficiary from that foreign policy debacle, but also, throughout the region, Iran has been able to exert its muscle in large part because there's very few political forces that can or military forces that can challenge their position, either in Syria or in Lebanon, things have been going fairly well for the Islamic Republic of Iran until recently. These protests in Iraq, these protests in Lebanon, and now protests back within the Islamic Republic of Iran have been, I think, a huge shock to the religious establishment. They don't know how to respond. One of the challenges that the Islamic Republic of Iran is facing in Lebanon and Iraq is that many of these people who are on the streets, they come from Shia backgrounds. This is the natural sort of segment of society that Iran would rely upon to support its policies. But they effectively have revolted against what one can call as, overreach, sort of an arrogant set of policies that Iran has pursued, thinking that it could get away with pursuing these policies. And now it's seeing its own blowback within Iraq, among Iraqi Shia segments of the population who are, deeply upset about what Iran has been doing in Iraq since 2003, and also, in Lebanon as well. And now, of course, the recent developments over the last couple of days is that within Iran itself, there are a series of protests that have, you know, that have brought tens of thousands of people into the street and have shaken the political establishment, and they really don't know how to respond to these developments. And so I would describe what Iran is facing today among the senior leadership of the Islamic Republic of Iran. There is deep panic and uncertainty about the future.
Well, the head of the Revolutionary Guards in the Quds, General Soleimani, he, of course, has been issuing these shoot-to-kill orders to the militias, Iranian-backed and controlled militias in Iraq. And as I mentioned earlier, they turned the tide for Assad when he was under siege from his own people in 2011. And you, of course, wrote a book about what happened with the Green Movement in Iran itself. The people reloaded the Green Movement and the struggle for Iran's future. They did the same thing. They issued shoot-to-kill orders to the IRGC and the Quds, did they not? Against the Iranian people, for God's sake.
That's correct. Although, you know, Iran has become much more sophisticated in terms of how it, you know, puts down protests. You know, it didn't engage. In 2009, Iran didn't do what Bashar al-Assad did in 2011, just engage in sort of gross mass murder. It did kill people on the streets, but it engaged in a much more sophisticated way of spreading terror by, you know, arresting tens of thousands of people, putting them in jail, roughing them up, scaring them, and then sending them back into the population to spread the word about what life is like when you're inside an Iranian prison. So Iran has sort of, really perfected the art of repressing political dissent. One of the interesting developments that sort of ties all this together was this report that came out in early October that Qasem Soleimani, the head of this, the Quds force, travels to Baghdad in the early days of the protests and convenes a meeting of the senior sort of security organizations in Iraq responsible for, you know, security and control, and basically chairs that meeting and sort of is quoted as saying that, look, we know how to deal with protests in Iran, and basically is advising the Iraqi, you know, security forces on how to deal with protests in Iraq. And we've actually seen the results of this. There's been over 300 people that have been killed in Iraq over the last month and a half, tens of thousands of injured people, a lot of them from these militia groups that Iran finances and supports. And we're seeing this playing itself out as we speak on the streets of Iran right now. So the Islamic Republic knows how to play this game of repression. It knows when to crack down hard. It knows when to, you know, play a sophisticated game of trying to retain power, and it's doing that throughout the region. Eventually, it's going to have blowback effects because, you know, you can't control these underlying grievances that millions of people have that are rooted in economic injustice, in poverty, in unemployment, but also in, deep political grievances and corruption, in the deep anger that people feel that a certain segment of the population is benefiting from the status quo while others are, you know, suffering. And so we're sort of, I think, seeing this sort of blowback taking place, a blowback in this case that affects the Islamic Republic of Iran and its authoritarian policies both at home and throughout the region.
And of course, the authorities, both the supreme leader in Iran has justified the hike in gas prices, which has got the people taking to the streets, and in retaliation, the supreme leader who controls the country along with the Quds and the Basij Pasdaran, they've just cut off internet now for several days since Saturday to try and stop people from communicating and getting more politically engaged. And the cables that you mentioned, the secret cables that have been released to The Intercept, they show a division though between the Ministry of Intelligence and Security, the Iran's CIA, if you will, and General Soleimani and the Quds. The Ministry of Intelligence and Security feel that the heavy-handed behavior of the Quds and the militias that they control shooting the Iraqis is actually backfiring and making life difficult for Iran's control of Iraq. So do you think, I mean, what's interesting is that we have a simplistic assumption here in the United States that because the Iraqis are Shia and so are the Iranians, therefore there's a religious bond. But the Iraqis are also nationalistic. So do you think that Iran may end up losing control or at least having to get more and more repressive to hold on to Iraq?
Well, I think we're seeing it right now. I mean, what's been so interesting about these protests in Iraq is that, you know, one of the target of the protesters' ire is precisely what was revealed in these cables, that Iran has too much influence. It basically effectively dominates the Iraqi political system. And Iran is supporting a set of, you know, political actors and political parties that are non-representative, that are corrupt, that have their own patron clientele networks, and vast majority of Iraqis are left out of this political equation, and they pay the, you know, the economic price for this set of arrangements. So I think Iran, you know, is facing a deep challenge to its influence over Iraq for precisely the reasons that you mentioned. You know, Iraqis do have, you know, long-standing cultural, religious ties with Iran. But, you know, Iraqis also are Iraqi citizens. They're nationalists. They don't want to see their country ruled by a neighboring regional power that dominates politics at the expense of the vast majority of Iraqi citizens. And so I think this is, I think, what we're seeing in Iraq today is I think, probably the biggest challenge to Iran's authority since the 2003 U.S. invasion, which, you know, changed the nature of Iraqi politics. And I don't think there's any easy situation and any easy outcome, because we're dealing with deep-seated, extensive, you know, economic grievances that exist. And, you know, there's no quick fix. It's not that you can, you know, turn on a light switch and everyone is going to have a job and a future. The problems of the Iraqi political system are chronic. They're deep-rooted. And they require, you know, serious political transformation and change. And Iran, ironically, you know, is on the side of the status quo. Iran likes to project itself, or historically, since the revolution, has projected itself as being on the side of street protests throughout the region. Right now, we're seeing Iran is actually on the side of the tormentors of the street protests, because that's where its political interests lie. And I think we're in for a very long period of instability and conflict around these issues.
Well, Nader Hashemi, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks, Ian, for the opportunity. Take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Nader Hashemi, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies and the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement, and The Struggle for Iran's Future. And his latest book is Sectarianization, Mapping the New Politics of the Middle East. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Standing along the side of the pickup truck. The headline written down in America. The guy that lived next door in 305 took the kids to the park and disappeared by 9:30. Who will ever know how much she loved them so? That dark night alone in America. Yeah.